All I can tell you is he told Randy, asked Randy if he would smoke the turkey, so, and he had about 15.
Very good.
He had 15, and I'm going to send out a...
That's all I know.
I'm going to send out an email tomorrow.
I almost said screw it and come over here Thursday night.
You can. That'd
have been fine, too.
You're more than welcome to.
Well, I haven't been on the meetings, but I'm still doing my homework, reading everything.
So. If you get the email, you get a link in the email to the file. Yeah. So you can
still watch.
Still, yeah, it's not. I just do the audio. I don't record the video.
Right.
Let's go to John chapter 1. Okay. What we've been talking about for the last 14 weeks is knowing God. And we have, over the past few weeks, been talking about what are considered to be veils. Okay, so the simplicity of understanding what the veils are is that from Exodus, you can start reading about the building of the tabernacle in chapter 25. And this is where it discusses the building of the Mishkan or the tabernacle. Now, the building of the tabernacle in the Torah takes up 50 chapters. So, 50 chapters out of 5 books is a lot of data. And that means that it's very, very important. Okay, so when God instructs Moses to begin to build the Mishkan, the construction of the Mishkan actually starts in a very interesting way. It starts from the Holy of Holies and works its way outward. Okay, so the initial idea is to understand that when God created or had Moshe construct the Mishkan, and he had Bezalel, who was a very deep spiritual person, who could see, let's put it this way, he could see into the spiritual world. So when Moshe would describe to him the construction of the Mishkan, he saw it. He could literally see it. But if you look in Shemot or Exodus 25, you can look at 25 and 9 and look at 25 and verse 40. You understand that it's built and it says, and it uses a word called tabnit in Hebrew, which means after a specific pattern. Okay? And this is very important in the... all of the understanding of, number one, God, but also the understanding of man's interaction and relationship with God. Because Genesis tells you, 1 and 28, that Adam was created in the image of God. Okay? The pattern of the divine. So you have the Mishkan, the tabernacle, being built according to a very specific pattern. And the pattern that it follows is what it says in verse 40, Moses, you make it according to the pattern that I showed you on the mountain. Okay, but it's interesting, that passage, because that passage puts it in the present tense. And instead of saying something that I showed you a few weeks ago when you were up here, it is saying that I am showing you on the mountain. And so that leads us to understand that Moshe was in the divine presence when he received the communication from Exodus 25. But it also is telling us that, you know, he was there in that spiritual realm. Therefore, God is saying, look, this is what I'm showing you, and this is what you need to see and what you need to understand. Okay? So Moshe, when he begins to tell Bezaleel how to construct the Mishkan. He gives him these very specific instructions. And Bezaleel, it says he was a man of Chochmah. Chochmah in Hebrew, of course, is wisdom. And so this man is a man of wisdom. Now, wisdom is a very, very peculiar thing in that what it does is it supersedes the natural world. Or in other words, it reaches beyond the spiritual world. Okay, so in Genesis, when God starts to create, he starts with the word Bereishit, okay? And it starts with the Hebrew letter Beit, or the B of the Hebrew alphabet. And the B is built in such a way that it looks like a hard, rigid shape that is almost a square without one side, and the one side that is open is on the left side of the letter. And remember that you read from right to left in this language. Okay, so then the idea is that you can't see beyond the beginning of creation. But here in John, and I'll read this and then we'll try to progress through this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was with God, and He was in the beginning with God. So something that you have there that is an oddity in these verses is that it says the word beginning. It talks about the beginning. It said He was in the beginning with God twice. Okay, so what this, according to the sages, whenever you have a mention of something twice, that means that there's two different applications of that verse. Okay, so in Zechariah 8 and 23, it says, in the last days, the men from the Gentile nations will take hold of the kanaf, or the fringe, of the garment of the Jewish man. So then the sages are asked, how come it says to take hold? It repeats this phrase twice in that particular verse. You may not read it in a English published Bible, but it should let you know that it is saying that twice. Nevertheless, the answer to the question is that it happened once, and it'll happen again. Okay, so you say, well, when did it happen the first time? And that is in the book of Acts. You can start reading, and you see the outpouring of the divine presence. But the outpouring of the divine presence is literally not what is understood as, quote, the Holy Spirit in terms of what Christianity understands, but it's the outpouring or the giving of the Torah. Okay, if you want to do a comparative study that will show you this truth, read Exodus chapter 18 and 19, more specifically 19, and read it, and then go to Acts chapter 2 and read Acts chapter 2. What you're going to find is, but the importance of understanding how things are said in the book of Shemot or Exodus comes from its Hebrew writing, okay? So it says that, you know, the people heard the thunder from the mountain and saw the lightning. In Acts chapter 2, it says they began to speak in different languages and they saw cloven tongues of fire over their head. It's an exact replica of what happened in Shemot 19, where it says, not in Hebrew, it does not say that they heard the thunder. It says they heard the voices. Okay, so I've discussed this before. This is not this morning's topic, but they heard voices. They heard the voices of God. It's other things, but nevertheless. So you could also say, and one of the things that the sages use or try to say when they talk about this is they said that God spoke the Torah in 70 languages. So all of the people of the world heard and understood the Torah in their own language. Therefore, everyone in the world is accountable to hearing and understanding the Torah. Okay, so then this mirrors the voices in languages, and then in Acts chapter 2, the languages that were being spoken, the tongues, the cloven tongues, etc., and then the fire that is seen over their head. This is all a picture of what happened on Har Sinai or Mount Sinai.
But it's also the anniversary of the same day.
It is the exact anniversary of the day. When it talks, it will talk about, when you look in Acts, it will say, when Pentecost had fully come. Okay, that means that you have finished what is understood as the counting of the Omer, which is the counting of 49 days. And then on the 50th day, we don't count 50, we celebrate the festival on the 50th day. Okay, so it is in fact the anniversary of the giving of the Torah. Both events took place on the biblical month, or in the biblical month of Sivan on the sixth day. So Sivan 6th was the giving of the Torah. It was the same day that the outpouring of the Ruach HaKodesh came, which the Ruach HaKodesh is also related to and associated, and the same thing as the Torah. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the things that we get when we come back to John is that God in the beginning, he had two beginnings in this verse. One beginning is the beginning of all beginnings, and the second beginning is the second beginning of physicality or physical things. Okay, so in other words, God starts, and you can even see this in Genesis, where it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens. Okay? So just use your spiritual imagination to understand that the heavens refers to the spiritual realms. Okay? So the first thing that God did was he created all the spiritual realms. And then the second thing he did was create what we call physicality. Okay? Bring us from a spiritual state into a state of physical existence. Now, what I have said for many years now is that when you first began, and it's not a creation, it's what we call an emanation. You flowed out of God. And that is hard to describe, but nevertheless, you flowed out of God. But you have to also understand that because you flowed out of God, you cannot be independent from God. Everybody with me? Okay, so there's a piece of you that can never be independent from God. You cannot be separated. That part of you is so holy that it actually supersedes spirituality. Now, I hope you understood what I said. Okay, because spirituality is a state, but it is also a force. It's also a power. It's a power of, like magnetism. So you have the nature, essence of God. You have the nature and the essence of soul, the soul. They're both the same thing. So what happens is, cling, they are magnetically, they're drawn together like a spiritual magnetism. You cannot keep the soul from its reconnection with God. Listen, even people, but understand this first. Not everybody that you see on the planet has a righteous soul. But the ones that do have righteous souls, you cannot keep them from eventually coming to God. They might, forgive the expression, go through hell on earth. And they may be involved on hell on earth, if you will. But nevertheless, that spark of the divine in the righteous soul will always turn and come to God. Always. Okay? So, here...
Excuse me, isn't that what it means about being the elect in Ephesians chapter 2?
Yeah, absolutely. Elect, translated into English, is chosen. So I also say that out of the endless stream of Adam's seed, you were selected. So understanding that you have a righteous soul, if you have that drawing toward God, and that means that not everybody in Adam's lineage has a righteous soul. Although originally that was the way it was intended to be.
So could you say that it said in the beginning that, so it would be the beginning of creation and then like the beginning of the Gospels or where Yeshua starts his ministry with 1 and 2 where it says it.
Okay, it said in the beginning there was the word. That word logos in Greek is so full of things that I gave away a set of books that was called the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. Each volume was about this thick and there were 10 volumes. The volume that deals with logos and the word logos takes up over 100 pages in that book, as does the word ruach. Okay,
we went over that one day in class a long, long time ago, and I left here so enlightened by just one single word.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It blew my mind.
So one of the things that it is also saying here when it uses the word logos, back to what Dr. Elisheva was saying in Ephesians 1 and 4, it says God chose you, and it uses a phrase, it's a compound word called eklegomaia. But it, again, you know me, I wanted to dissect the word. So what I do is I dissect it, and when I take it back to its foundational root, then you understand that what it says is logos. So before the beginning, there is a logos. That's exactly what's being said here, okay? But the logos is, number one, the Torah. Number two, it's Messiah. Number three, it's you. Okay, so you can look at this and say, in the beginning, I was, and the word I was with God in the beginning. Okay, and then it will say, and he was in the beginning with God. And so there you see there's two beginnings. Okay, but one is the realm of spirituality, which always starts first. And the second is the realm of physicality. Okay. There are a lot of things to say about why this comes about, but this is not this morning's discussion. Go ahead. You have another question?
No, I just had a the light bulb went off.
The light turned on.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's the way it's supposed to be. Said, in him was life, and that life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness cannot comprehend it. And there was a man who was sent from God, whose name was Yochanan, John. And this man came to be a witness, to bear witness of the light, and that all through him might believe. And he was not the light, but he was sent to bear witness of the light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. There's a whole lot of light here going on. And he was in the world, and the world was made through him. And the world, as many as received them, he gave them the authority to be called and to become the children of God, to those who believe or they have the authority of his name, who were born not of blood, not of the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. Okay, so this is a description of the inner part of your being that does what we call emanate. It flows out from God. So that part of you before the physical creation emanated from God. Now, every righteous soul that is an emanation of God, they all are. If it's a righteous soul, it emanates from God. It has already seen God. Okay, now you have to dispel a myth. It says if you see God, you're going to die. Okay, let's put it this way. If you see God in the flesh, if he manifests to you in the flesh, you will die. No two ways about it. But, and there is an example of this in Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7, Stephen, it said he looked in the heavens and he saw God. And when he saw God, he died. Okay? How he died. It said they were throwing stones at him. That's a lie. That's not how Jewish people stone people. Anyway, that's another subject. But nevertheless, what happens is that he sees God. And so he leaves this world and he goes to the next world. Okay? I think the same thing happened to Enoch. Okay? He was with God and then he was not. He was not where? He was not here on the physical world anymore. He just thought the door to the spirituality opened. He walked through it and he wasn't in this world anymore. So that dispels a myth. Somebody says, you know, that can't happen, blah, blah, blah. It dispels the myth that it can't happen. It can happen. And it doesn't mean that, you know, anything that Yeshua is negated. It means that that's what Yeshua came to reveal and what he came to give us insight into. Okay? So the soul was with God. It has seen God. Now, in order for man to act in the way that you and I can act today, what has to happen is there has to be what we call a veil, or we have to have these, it has to be veils or some sort of obstruction to the view, okay? The reason is you can't take the divine presence and have the light of God diminished. So you can't say, God, turn down your light for a minute. He cannot do it. Okay? It's not possible for him to make himself less than what he is. Okay? So, and it's impossible for him to become anything but what he is. So then you would say, okay, God created the righteous souls. The righteous souls are sent on a mission to the earth. On Sabbath, we discuss this. We say that we are the builders. Okay, so we were the ones who were the builders of the cosmos. Here it is showing you Yeshua, the Messiah, and Messiah is the first of the righteous souls to emanate from God. Okay, and he is associated with the idea of chokmah or wisdom. But then God knows that he needs everything to be constructed and everything to go in life exactly the way he wants it. That conversation from Ephesians chapter 1 verse 4 is a conversation you and I had with God before the foundation of the world, it says in Ephesians. And so Tevin and I were there having a discussion, and we decided that we were going to come to earth, we were going to be there at the same time, and this is the things that we're going to work on, study, and teach. Okay, so then what happens in history is God said, look, Tevin and Dr. Oakley are friends. And so because they're friends, I'm going to make them live at the same time. Okay, but he and I already made this commitment and an oath to one another that we would do this, that we would become friends, and that we would share a ministry, we would share a revelation, etc., etc. But now the thing is, a couple of years ago, Tevin wasn't fit for that work. But God knows what's going on. And so what does he do? Tevin, I got a job for you. And Tevin doesn't even know that God's talking to him, but he's talking to that inner being of him. And so before too long, no matter where Tevin is or was or whatever, God begins to use that spiritual magnetism and start to draw him closer to God. And thus, you know, the magnetism also has interesting properties, right? So if he's a magnet and I'm a magnet and God's a magnet, what's going to happen?
Yeah, a lot of suction.
A lot of magnet going on.
Magnetized. What do you call it?
Spiritual magnetism, spiritual drawing, okay? Now, let's go to 12, John 12. So in order to live, we have to have these veils in place. So in other words, you can't diminish the light of God, but you can hide the light of God. Okay, so you have to put something over the light. And if you put something over light, which will happen tomorrow, okay, what's going to happen is something's going to pass in front of the light, and the light, it's going to turn dark. Okay, So the process is here, a spiritual picture of the things that we experience in the process of coming to this world, okay? As we come to this world, we have to put a veil. We have to put a veil. We have to put a veil. And then it comes down to us. We can try to look up, but we can't see God. We can't see God with the spirit, the physical eye, but we can see it with the spiritual eye.
You can feel it.
You can feel it. It is a natural physical reaction. You can feel when the Spirit of God is close. Okay? Some people describe it as the hair standing up on the back of their neck or whatever it might be. But then when the presence comes, you can feel the presence with no question. Okay, so, but what you have to understand is that spiritual being can see God. And so what you have to get rid of is the concept of looking through the physical eye and understand that when you're going to look at God, you have to look through at God through the spiritual eye. Okay? Everybody with me? Verse 37, 12:37. Go ahead.
So pretty much the physical eye is a veil.
It is a veil, absolutely. Yeah. Physicality is a veil, the whole thing. And that's the deal about being put inside of a case of flesh. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 says, we have this treasure in a clay jar, in earthen vessels, is the way it reads in the older language, in King James, okay? It means that God deposited the light inside of a vessel. This vessel is called a kli, K-E-L-I, kli. And the language and what the rabbis say is that there are these things that are called klipot. Klipot is just a plural for the fact that there are all of these different types of vessels. Now, the klipot have different types of existence. But nevertheless, we are put inside of this vessel, and inside of that vessel, there is a light. And that light is literally the divine essence that's inside of us. But it can see, but it doesn't use the physical eye. But when we start to gather spiritual information, it has to first come through the head. Mm-hmm. Because you don't realize that you're getting all this information, but the information doesn't come. It comes in the form of how we just read, light. Light, 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 light. Okay, so when it comes in the form of light, your spirit man sees all of it. But it then starts to talk to your physical being. Okay? Has to do it through the brain, right? So when it starts to talk to its your physical being, it's trying to tell you about what you experience with God. But it can't tell you in terms of physicality, so it has to, number one, trigger your imagination. And number two, it has to start in what is called symbolism. Mm-hmm. Okay? So what you receive is imagined spiritual symbolism. And then that is decoded by the brain, but it still is veiled in a thick layer of physicality. But the more and the more and the more that you have that experience, the easier it is for you to see. And you can open your eyes and you can look and you're seeing the spiritual world, but you don't realize that what is happening is it's the spiritual person inside of you seeing, and it's making a communication with your brain that, you know, even though that you see, you don't understand. One time, many, many years ago, 1986, just thereafter, I was going to a Bible bookstore, and the owner of the bookstore told me about a man who was able to see into the spiritual world, but when he was looking into the spiritual world, it scared him. And forgive the expression, but sometimes it can be scary as hell. And so what happens is once you start looking at it, you see things that nobody else sees. And when that begins to happen and you see it, people catch you looking. And they know what you're doing. And so I started seeing into the spiritual world, and as I was seeing into the spiritual world, sure enough, I could see things that were happening in people's lives. And they didn't know I was looking at the spiritual person and seeing what was going on with their spirituality. Okay? But then pretty soon they see you looking, and they know that that's what you're doing, looking. So when I would walk into the room, they'd say, shh, Walter's here. Because they knew I was going to look, and they knew I could see what was going on. So one time, to describe the what it looks like when you see somebody looking into that world, I was working in Palm Springs. Now, to go from where I lived to Palm Springs was about an hour and a half drive. And I would always go what I call the back way, and that would be over the mountain. And so when we would get to the place that we would start to go down the mountain into Palm Springs, I would always turn on literally acid rock, okay? Because we're going to go down a thing that looks like a snake thrown out on the ground in downhill incline. So all of my guys would wake up and they would know that here we are, we're going down the mountain, okay? But on the way back, we would go through a community that had been there, of course, for many years. And I was looking into the spirit world. One of the guys was in the truck, in the front of the truck with me, and he saw me looking into the spiritual world. And what I was seeing was the angels dancing around an encampment. And I said, kind of like Moshe, this is holy ground. Somebody very special either lives here or lived here. Come to find out, I went and I told a friend, I said, I was in this place and I could see the angels dancing around an encampment. He goes, were you here? And he told me the place where it was. It was not too far from where he used to live as a child. It's where Catherine Kuhlman had her place of residence in ministry. And those that don't know Catherine Kuhlman, she was a mighty woman of God. Okay, she was a very, very spiritual woman. But back to the truck. The guy sees me looking at it, and he says, Walter, Walter. And I said, what? He said, are you awake? And I said, yeah, I'm awake. He goes, you look like a rabbit who's sleeping. So when a rabbit sleeps, he sleeps with his eyes open. Okay, but he's like got this fixed gaze. He doesn't move his eyes. It's just staring straight forward. And that's what he saw me doing. Now, what happens is, again, the physical is connecting through the physical eye, but the physical eye cannot see. But when you see with the spiritual eye through the physical eye, then you see these spiritual things. And when you see these spiritual things, the eye can't use its normal functionality. It has to stop. Because if it sees God, it'll die. Okay? So you have to allow the spirit to be the manifest part of that being. Okay? So we can see God, but if we see God with the physical eye, if he literally materialized in front of us, it's just time to go.
Okay? So it would be kind of like prophecy.
It is prophecy.
It would be what John saw in Revelation.
It is prophecy. Okay, look it. There are four spiritual worlds above us. Okay? If you were able to go to the next spiritual world above us, which is called Yetzirah, which means the world of formation, this is where the prophets saw when they went into that. So, if you were able to go into that world, one of the things that's going to happen when you go into that world is tomorrow. It's not today, it's tomorrow. Okay? So if you go in that world, you're tomorrow, and then when you come back into this world, you're today. So what happens? You see tomorrow, okay? And or a month from now, et cetera. So the higher in the realm of the spirit that you move, the higher the gift of prophecy and the further the gift of prophecy. Okay, now let's go back to the fact that deposited within you is the divine spark. Okay, suppose you have the ministry of trying to rescue these sparks, okay? So in other words, you're trying to find the righteous souls in the cosmos. And you have people that have been through hell on earth and they have their spark inside, but it's hidden and you can't see it. Okay? Not with the physical eye. So what do? You want to look for it. And once you find that this is, in fact, a righteous soul, you want to bring redemption to it. That, in other words, that means that you want to bring it out of the darkness into the light. And when you try to bring it out of the darkness into the light, you are doing what they call tikkun. You're making a repair and elevating something, okay? In order to do this, you have to literally ascend past the world of Yetzirah into the world that's called Biria, okay? Which that word means creation, but it's not a physical creation. It's this first creation that you saw in John. So when you go into that world, that's where you can look around in the spirit and say, oh, there's one of those sparks right there. And then you find that spark, and then what you do is you go to that spark and you, as I said, I think the other night, you breathe on it. Okay? And I think it was Sheba that said, yeah, you know, when you are lighting a fire and you first get it started, you start to do what? You feed oxygen to it, you breathe it, and then the light and the fire increases. So obviously, I want you to be out of the physical world here thinking in spiritual terms. Okay? I'm not talking about you see somebody, you just go blow on them. Now, there was... But listen, now...
That would be so much easier if that was...
Sure, sure. But how many of you ever saw Benny Hinn?
Oh, God, I love him.
Okay, what did he do? He would breathe on them.
Yeah.
Okay? He wasn't breathing on them with his breath. My God, he just had a garlic sandwich.
Right.
Not really. But the point is, he was doing something spiritual. He was enacting a spiritual reality through physical means. Okay? And so, he would breathe on these people. The reason he would breathe is because the Word of God, when it goes out of the mouth, it has a restorative capacity. God said, my word will not return to me in the state of vanity. Okay? So when God's word goes out, you speak to the word. Okay? If you speak to a soul that is truly a righteous spark, somebody that you think is a righteous spark, and it really is a righteous spark, what happens? That spirit starts, that ember inside starts to glow. And once it begins to glow, then that spirit starts to ignite with fire. A spark to the flame, and then what happens? Things begin to ascend from that point because fire is going to always go upward.
So breathing, in a sense, on that spirit is pretty much increasing the magnetism.
Yeah, it's increasing the magnetism, but it's increasing the light so that the light can become visible. Okay?
Okay.
Imagine again that it's encased in something. Okay? Okay. First of all, what happens in the spiritual world is light is light. Okay? So, what you need to understand is that I call it the Sitra Achra, okay? I do not like this idea or thought of the devil or Satan or anything, because a lot of that has many misconceptions, okay? But the side of the Sitra Achra, which is side of negativity, it has one goal in mind, and that is to obscure the light. That's the mirror of what God does. Okay? But it does it in a sense of negativity. Okay? Why? So, you're looking around and you can't see anything but, quote, darkness. And the reason you can't see anything but darkness is because the Sitra Achra has enveloped everything in darkness. Why? Because he wants to hide God. He does not want you to see God.
And keep the spark from igniting.
Exactly. But not only that, if he can, you know, convince you far enough, or anyone far enough, they'll believe there is no God. And, or they'll believe that I can do whatever the hell I want because there is no God and I'm in charge.
Right.
Kind of sound like the world we live in today?
Yeah.
Okay, so you understand that what is happening here is that this negative force encapsulates the spark, And then, if you're looking into the spirit world and you have no idea of what you're looking at, you never see it.
You miss a whole lot.
You miss everything. You miss everything because the whole idea of what you're trying to do is to gather those sparks. Okay? And so, once you're trying to gather the sparks, you have to be able to see that ember inside. When I was 19 years old, I worked on a ranch. And when I worked on that ranch, I call it my exile. Because when I worked there, I had no contact with the outside world. I was on 162 acres of avocados and oranges. And it was my job to see to it that everything was irrigated appropriately. And then that is in the Southern California heat. Okay. So that was my job. Every day to do the same thing. Same thing day after day. And so what happened inside of me, I started to get cold on God. And I knew that I had a call from God from the time I was 6 years old. But I started to get very cold on God, and God began to be very distant to me. And so I had been going to school full-time and working full-time. So I'd leave in the morning about 4 o'clock, go to work, work until about 6:30, and then go to school, and then come back by just after lunch sometime. So once I quit school, there's another story in that, but once I quit school, I started working there full-time. And so it was go to work to the same place every day, do the same thing every day, and no potential for spiritual growth, no whatever. But I started to realize what was happening to me. I knew I was drawing away from God in this process. So I intentionally tried to embrace one of the challenges, literally the first challenge that was ever given to me as a spiritual young man at 15. And that was to think about God every second of the day when my mind was not occupied with something else. Okay? So guess what? If you're doing the same thing day after day after day, we call it now muscle memory. Your body is robotic. It just does it. Okay? That frees the mind to be able to concentrate on God. And so I started this process of trying to reattach myself to God because I had grown cold on God. So one day in the process, I was near the finish of a cycle. So every cycle took me 2 hours to accomplish. Okay, so every 2 hours, the water had to be changed from one station to the next station. Okay, so I was very close. It was near the end of the day, in the afternoon anyway, sometime after lunch. And what happened to me was I heard a voice, literally an audible voice calling my name. So my father worked for the same company that I work for. And what I did was I thought, he's come, you know, to check on me today. So I go out to the road, and it was basically, you know, our practice that he would come to the road. So there's a road that came in. This is where I would have heard him, and he would have called to me from about this position in the road, but the road would go down to the ranch, etc. But if you pull forward just a little bit ways, there's a road that would connect to that road from the lower part of the ranch. So if he came and he called for me, the basic understanding was that he would pull up to that road in his truck and that I could walk out to the road and I could see that he was there. Okay? So I heard, I thought it was my father's voice saying, "Walter." So when I heard this voice, I thought it was him. So the practice was walk to the edge of the road and I will see him. So I walked and I waited for a couple minutes. I did not see him. And so I went back to my duty of, you know, continuing the cycle. And then what happened was I heard the voice again. And so I walked to the road and looked up, and I couldn't see it. So I didn't see. I thought maybe he had driven past, or he was, you know, not quite at that point in the approach to the ranch. And so I walked to the top of the second road where I could see from there, you know, all down that road. I did not see him. So from that position, there was another incline that went up. And from that it was the peak of the ranch. You could see the whole ranch from there. And he had a white truck, a white Ford four-wheel drive truck. And so I knew, you know, I could look and I could watch. And if the truck was moving, I knew where I would be able to see the moving, it moving on a road that was through the thing. He wasn't there. Nowhere on the ranch. And so then at that juncture, you're thinking like, you know, I don't know what's going on. And you go back down, and then all of a sudden it occurred to me that there was a story in the Bible where it happened to another young boy. And it was Samuel. And Samuel was called three times before he understood. Only he had more spiritual guidance than I did, because he went to his mentor and he said, you know, I've heard this voice. And he said, next time you hear that voice, he said, it's God. Answer him. You answer him. And so that's what happened to me. I realized that it was God's voice. I could not imagine God wanting to talk with me. Somebody in the middle of nowhere, a nobody, etc., in exile. I said, how could God want to talk to me? But when I heard the voice again, I made an altar, as it were, underneath of an orange tree. Mm-hmm. And for 3 hours, I had a vision. A vision of my entire life. The first part of the vision opens up. An angel escorts me. His name is Bier. Bier Lecheroi, which means the well of the living one who sees. He's an angel of resurrection. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die again. Because I had died when I was six. And I thought, I'm going to die again. And I didn't realize that, no, I wasn't going to die. But I was going to have a spiritual elevation at that point. And so this angel, he takes me to a building. It's a very large sanctuary. And it is filled with people. The back had colored stained glass windows in it. And it had a stage that was a very big square of wood on this stage. And it was lined with purple curtains. All of it's a spiritual imagery. It's like looking at the book of Revelation. And that's exactly what was happening to me. I was in a revelation, like the revelation. What I heard was, again, the divine voice. And as I was looking across the congregation of the people that were there, thousands, and I heard the voice saying, redeem these souls. And I looked into the congregation, and nearly everyone in the congregation was dressed in a black robe with a hoodie, having the hoodie pulled up over their head, like, you know, you see guys going down the street that, you know, that's the way they want to semi-disguise themselves. So when I saw these black-robed individuals or things or whatever, and I hear God saying, redeem these souls, I'm like, are these souls? And I started to pay attention and look, and I looked into the robe, and in that opening of where the face would be, there was no face, but there was an amber spark, an amber ember glowing inside of that thing, but it was very faint. And as I began to speak, breathe on those souls, if you will, then I could see at different places and at different times in the congregation, which is a expression of my life throughout a period of history, right? It's not a single moment, it's time. And so I saw that ember spark. And when I saw that ember spark, I would speak to that spark. You would have laughed if you heard the sermon. Because I didn't say, if you don't repent, you're going to die and go to hell. I didn't even say, you know, if you will embrace God, then you will be this spiritual creature. I didn't have any sermon like that whatsoever. You know what I did? I said, Sally, George, Monique, Sarah, I call them by their essence, just like Adam did with all of the animals. Wow. And when you call them by their essence, they have to conform to their true nature. They have to become their true thing. And so, if you get out of line, all I have to do is say, Tevin. And you can't help it. Okay? So this is what happened in that moment. I saw that spark enveloped in that darkness. And that is what the Sitra Achra, the side of negativity, that's what it wants to do. Okay, but there are also things that are out there, like gifts. God wants to give you a gift. And He wants to use you in a way that literally you can't imagine. And then when He wants to give you that gift, you're looking for the gift, but you can't see the gift because it's shrouded in that light of negativity. But when you learn to develop yourself spiritually, what happens to you is you can look into the spiritual world. You look like a rabbit looking at, you know, it's asleep, but you're staring into the spiritual world. And then what happens is the veil that's on the outside is penetrated and you see through. And then it could be sort of like the idea of looking at hunting for the core of the onion. Okay, so you remove the peel. So after you've removed a couple of those peels, what happens? You begin to see that this thing is taking the shape of the core of whatever is there. So in the spiritual world, when you're looking into the spiritual world and you see something enshrouded in a veil, what happens is as you stare past that veil, you have to stare spiritually until you get to the point of seeing past the first layer. Once you see past the first layer, what happens is you see that there's, look at that. What is that? That it's kind of almost like it's glowing right there. And then you remove the second layer. And it's actually just like a warm glow. You know how a fire will glow when it gets air. It'll move, it'll change brightness, etc. So what you do is you look at the past that second veil, and then the shape of the ember begins to increase and you see it. And not only that, you see an increase of the light. Okay? So this is a process that you go about spiritually when you're looking for those righteous sparks. But the whole point of everything that I wanted to say this morning is that this is the whole point of the spiritual negativity. Let's go to Isaiah. Chapter 6. Isaiah. I like when people read this chapter in the Bible. There's 99% of the people who read this chapter in the Bible are ignorant. You know why they're ignorant? They didn't read chapter 5. They didn't read chapter 4. And they don't know anything about Uzziah. Sit in the year that King Uzziah died, everybody should say, yay!
He was a tyrant.
No, not so much the tyrant. What's the next festival, biblical festival we're approaching?
Passover.
What do we do when we're going into Passover, preparing for Passover? We hunt for all the leaven in the house. And the leaven represents
pride.
Somebody swelled up that thinks that they are more important than what they are. This is King Uzziah. Okay? So what you see is that King Uzziah has died. And then all of a sudden it says, and I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and His kanaf, the corner of His tallit, filled the entire temple. He saw something so spiritual that he literally saw God wearing a tallit. And he sees the fringe. It says there the hem or the train. Train is the outflowing pieces of his robe, which are the fringes to his tallit. And he said, you know, I saw him high and lifted up. You don't understand that the only way that you could see God in this manner is for King Uzziah to die. And it's the picture of leaven. It's comets. It's leaven. What then did this guy do that obscured the divine presence? So what you understand, this guy as a king of Israel, and what he did is he totally turned off the light. No spiritual light coming into Israel whatsoever. No capacity to look into the heavens and see the Spirit of God. What did he do? The only way he could accomplish this is to go to the temple and do something very heinous at the temple. Okay? You remember the temple is what? It's the point of contact between the lower world and the spiritual world. This is the Mishkan we talked about a few minutes ago. So the point of contact between the upper world and the lower world comes through the temple in those days. Okay? So this king decides he's going to go to the temple. Okay? Guess what? There's a gate there that says king's not allowed. No, it doesn't literally say that. It's a spiritual law. Kings are not allowed. You can come here. You can worship. You can whatever. But the duty inside is given to specific men. They're called Kohanim priests. And what is their job? To draw the light down into the temple and then let it shine out to the world. That's their job. Okay? And so, what happened was, the king said, I'm the king. I can do the priestly work and it'll be fine. But I'm so important that God will circumvent spiritual law for me.
I've known people like that.
Yeah, sure. No, God has to have me. He doesn't need a priest. God already established things. You start reading in Exodus 25, and then you read, and then before too long, God, he does what? He consecrates. He sets aside a specific group for a specific job of maintaining and occupying and working inside of that device. The king says, no, we don't need a priest. I'm going to be the priest. The problem is that he saw it first in the spiritual world. And what is the blasphemy that he does? He saw the days of Messiah. He saw Messiah. Why? Messiah is going to circumvent the priesthood because he's going to reenact the priesthood of the firstborn. The priesthood of Melchizedek. Okay? It's the priesthood of the firstborn. You're a priest to me forever after the order of Melchizedek. Every firstborn boy in the family is a priest. So what did he do? What was his thing? He went into the temple and he was going to be the one who would do the sacrifices. He was the one who was going to go to the Holy of Holies to do all of these different things. And you know what God said? Nah. You can't be Messiah because you're lifted up with pride. Did you ever see Yeshua do that? He said, don't tell anybody who I am. He wanted to conceal who he was. Not for the sake of, you know, hiding the truth of God, but because he understood the process of concealment and understood that, listen, here's the law, the first law of concealment. Sanctity has to be veiled. It has to be veiled from physicality. Okay? So what did he do? He said, I'm the priest. He was saying, I'm the Messiah. But he did it with arrogance and pride. So, you know, God, he's one of those ones that when he set the rules, he says, this is the rule and you will obey the rules. If you violate the rules, what's going to happen to you?
die.
You die. You're going
to
die.
Okay, so what happens to this guy? God says he does it in a way that's really peculiar, right? Yeah. You're going to die. But you understand I didn't say, like, you're going to die right now. He said, you're going to die. But it's going to be slow, painful, and miserable. So he smote him with leprosy. It's a skin disease. Today there's something semi-similar called Hansen's disease.
Your skin rots off.
The skin will rot off, but the skin doesn't rot off because...
there's no feeling.
It's like this. To describe it, okay, when you stick your hand underneath the hot water, what happens?
It's hot.
Once it's hot, you stick your hand in it, you know, your hand recoils. Okay? So, if a leper sticks his hand underneath the hot water, he doesn't recoil because he can't feel the heat. He could do the same time, also the, go to the face. He's going to wash his face. And what's going to happen when he washes his face with that hot water? Okay? The sensation is dead in the hand. Okay? It's not the exact same as what it was in biblical times. Hansen's disease is not leprosy, biblical leprosy. But nevertheless, that means, you know, he turns white. Okay? So what this guy did is he went into the temple, basically, and he turned the light off. God's light was not coming down anymore.
So biblical leprosy sometimes is just to be cast out.
It will always result in being cast out. Always.
So what you explained earlier of what the Sitra Achra does, it was that illustration you give is exactly what it is.
Yeah, okay. But what you understand is that God concealed sanctity, holiness, okay, to protect his holiness. Okay, but the Sitra Achra wants to mirror that and hide the holiness so that you don't believe that there's a God. Okay, so you see the difference. I want you to elevate yourself spiritually so you can see me. That's God's voice. Okay, elevate yourself and you will be able to see me. I'm visible to your spirituality. Okay, but the Sitra Achra on the other side envelops that everything that's good in the world is enveloped in that spirit, that concealment. Okay, that encasement, and that is so that what happens is everybody thinks that there's no God. Okay, so science can be the concealment of truth. Okay? What are scientists trying to conceal? The fact that God created right. The cosmos. Guess what? It happened like this. You know, after a million billion years of the world going around and around, then, you know, all of a sudden, there was this one little planet, and it just happened that it was filled with 3/4 of water. We can't see them in any other one like this in all of the cosmos. And it had all this water. And then one day, this thing that was a single cell turned into...
the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
It's not even the Big Bang Theory.
You crawled out of the lake and it's caca.
And there you are.
Or that I used to swing from trees and eat bananas.
Yes, 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 yes.
Sorry, you may have.
They're still conceived.
Because that's what God allows.
Exactly.
Okay, that's what God... In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4. So God has, the God of this world has blinded the mind of those who do not believe.
Even Einstein.
Einstein wanted to conceal the truth.
Exactly.
You know what Einstein said? If the universe is infinite, there's no God. But if it's finite, there is a God. And with the theory of relativity, what did he do? He proved that the cosmos was finite. And you know what he did?
He went home and cried.
No, he didn't go home and cried. He tried to change the numbers.
Right. That's a true story.
It is.
It's a true story.
Okay, so we're at the end of our time. So you understand that Number one, God conceals his holiness to protect his holiness. The Sitra Achra, the side of negativity, tries to conceal everything that's good, so he will pull the veil over the world and make them think there's no such thing as a God.
And that'd be as simple as putting in areas and things in your lives that is doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
A whole little thing.
Absolutely. Trying to influence your life to that particular influence to where you don't even realize.
You just start adding all the veils.
Well, what you're in, you go into a place that is veiled. Mm-hmm. Okay? You know, it's like going into a tent. When you go into the tent, you can't look outside. And I think I told this class or somebody, I don't know, the discussion is interesting because what happened is the Israelis, they decided to create a virtual reality inside of a tank. Was it Thursday night? Okay, so they create a device that's called the, you know, everybody has seen the virtual reality goggles that people wear. Then we're in this, they're looking at the goggles and they're looking around. You think, what's wrong with them? Okay, but they're seeing something that is a computer projected image. Okay, Israeli said, hey, this is a wonderful idea. You can't see outside of the tank. So what we'll do is we'll put cameras all the way around the tank. Put a helmet on a guy that has visual representation of everything that's going on, a computerized version of reality. And so if he wants to see outside, instead of having to look, you know, through a little bitty glass and only see a little bitty portion of what he can see, he looks with the helmet, he can see through the side of the tank, and he can look all the way around the tank and tell exactly what kind of environment he's
in. Joe Biden said that was cheating.
It is cheating, but guess what? The idea is that it's not cheating. And the other thing is, and I told this Thursday night, now that Sheva has reminded me, you know, the Jews bought, I don't know the number, they bought several Tomcat F-14s. Yeah. Everybody know what I'm talking about? The Top Gun airplane. Okay, they bought a bunch of these. And you think, wow, you know, that was pretty cool. They buy all these airplanes. You know what they did? They completely disassembled it. They took it apart. They didn't care about the airplane. They didn't want an airplane. You know what they wanted? They wanted the avionics on the aircraft.
They wanted the technology from it.
Okay, so what they did is the F-14 was the first aircraft that could go into battle and never see the opposition. Through its intellect, its electronic intellect, it could see 100 miles away, there's an enemy aircraft approaching me at Mach 2, 3, whatever the speed might be. And so the pilot can see this. He can lock onto that target, never see it, and fire and destroy that aircraft without ever seeing it.
Wow.
He can engage in a battle that way. So the Israelis said, if it works good on an airplane, it'll work on a tank.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And so they took all the avionics off the aircraft and put it on the tank so they can go into battle, never see the enemy or the object that they want to fire at. They can fire at it and destroy it from whatever the distance is that the missile from the tank or the cannon from the tank can reach. So this is all a picture of spirituality, being able to see in the spiritual world. And so it's a spiritual thing that they apply to a physical object. It's not wrong. It's wisdom.
Oh,
it's extreme intelligence. And so that's what it... So when this recent stuff with the Hamas goes on, you don't understand, let's say, the difficulty that I had. And the reason is, and Dr. Lesheba, because we were there, we've seen those tanks, we know what they could do. They can make themselves almost invisible, and they can make themselves invisible on the field to another missile that is being fired at them.
They spray that freon gas.
They spray
it cold, and I mean, they can, whenever the glass clears, they're standing right in your face with a, and you don't even know they got there. That was scary.
Okay, so they used different...
Yeah, that sounds scary.
Yeah, they use different mechanisms. Number one, they use Freon gas for heat-seeking missiles. Okay? The other thing is, what is the real problem that they have? Let's suppose that you're in battle with the tank, a metal device. And so what do you want to do? Just put a magnetic device on the tank so that attach it to the tank that will explode, blow up the tank. You can't do that to an Israeli tank. In the back on the turret, there's all these little chains, and they have a ball about that big around that hangs from that. It goes all around the back side of the turret. It emits an electrical field that is anti-magnetic. Oh, wow. You cannot put anything magnetic on it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh,
but one of the things.
Put him on the home up front line.
Yeah.
You
wouldn't know where
he was. He's fall off the stage.
I'm afraid they're getting ready to turn their back on Israel.
Well.
Much have already, but it's getting ready.